Hello everyone, my name is Elijah Dave Mission of the 12th Hour Apostolic Sabbatarian Congregation out of the 12th Hour Liberty, York, Texas. Today is March 5, 2017, or the VHR 7, 2020. We will start our first service today with a song entitled, Open My Eyes That I May See. Open my eyes that I may see glimpses of truth thou hast for me. Place in my hand a wonderful key that shall unclasp and set me free. Silently now I wait for thee, ready my eyes I will to see. Open my eyes, illumine me, sanctify. Open my ears that I may hear voices of truth thou sendest clear. And while the wave blows fall on my hair, everything false will disappear. Silently now I wait for thee, ready my eyes I will to see. Open my ears, illumine me, spirit to define. Open my mouth and let me bear gladly the warm truth everywhere. Open my heart and let me prepare love with the children thus to share. Silently now I wait for thee, ready my love I will to see. Open my heart, illumine me, spirit define. Part 3, we're on Patriarchs and Prophets, Cain and Abel Tested. We're on page 74. It says that Cain hated and killed his brother, not for any wrong that Abel had done, but because his own works were evil and his brother's righteous. So in all ages, the wicked have hated those who were better than themselves. Abel's life of the obedience and unswerving faith was unto Cain a perpetual reproof. Everyone that doeth evil hateth the light, neither cometh to the light, lest his deeds should be reproved. The brighter the heavenly light that is reflected from the character of the Yahweh's faithful servant, the more clearly the sins of the unrighteous are revealed, and the more determined will be their efforts to destroy those who disturb their peace. For the murder of the Abel was the first example of the enmity that Elohim had declared would exist between the serpent and the seed of the woman. Between Satan and his subjects and Yahshua and his followers, through man's sin, Satan had gained control of the human race. But Yahshua would enable them to cast off his yoke. Whenever through faith in the Lamb of Yahweh, a soul renounces the service of sin, Satan's wrath is kindled. The holy life of Abel testified against Satan's claim that it is impossible for man to keep Yahweh's law. When Cain, moved by the spirit of the wicked one, saw that he could not control Abel, he was so enraged that he destroyed his life. And wherever there are any who will stand in the vindication of the righteousness of the law of Yahweh, the same spirit will be manifested against them. It is a spirit that through all the ages has set up the stake and kindled the fire or the burning pile for the disciples of the Yahshua. both the cruelties heaped upon the follower of Yahshua was instigated by Satan and his host because they cannot force him to submit to their control, for it is the rage of a vanquished foe. Every martyr of Yahshua has died a conqueror, says the prophet. They overcame him, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, and they loved not their lives unto the death. Cain the murderer was soon called to answer for his crime. Yahweh said unto Cain, Where is Abel thy brother? And he said, I know not. Am I my brother's keeper? Cain had gone so far in sin that he had lost a sense of the continual presence of Yahweh and his greatness and omniscience. So he resorted unto the falsehood to conceal his guilt. Again the Yahweh said unto Cain, What hast thou done? The voice of thy brother's blood crieth unto me from the ground. Yahweh had given Cain an opportunity to confess his sin. He had had time to reflect. He knew the enormity of the deed he had done and of the falsehood he had uttered to conceal it. But he was rebellious still, and sentence was no longer deferred. The divine voice that had been heard in entreaty and admonition pronounced the terrible words, And now art thou cursed from the earth, which hast opened her mouth to receive thy brother's blood from thy hand. When thou tillest the ground, it shall not henceforth yield unto thee her strength. A fugitive and a vagabond shalt thou be in the earth. Notwithstanding that Cain had, by his crimes, merited the sentence of death, a merciful Creator still spared his life and grant him opportunity for repentance. But Cain lived only to harden his heart, to encourage rebellion against the divine authority, and to become the head of a line of bold, abandoned sinners. The one apostate led by Satan became a tempter unto others, and his example and influence exerted their demoralizing power until the earth became so corrupt and filled with the violence as to call for its destruction. In sparing the life of the first murderer, Yahweh presented before the whole universe a lesson bearing upon the great controversy, the dark history of Cain and his descendant, was an illustration of what would have been the result of permitting the sinner to live on forever to carry out his rebellion against Yahweh. For the forbearance of Yahweh only rendered the wicked more bold and defiant in their iniquity. 15 centuries after the sentence pronounced upon Cain, the universe witnessed the fruition of his influence and example in the crime and pollution that flooded the earth. It was made manifest that the sentence of the death pronounced upon the fallen race for the transgression of Yahweh's law was both just and merciful. No longer men lived in sin. The more abandoned they became, the divine sentence cutting short a career of unbridled iniquity and freeing the world from the influence of those who had become hardened in the rebellion was a blessing rather than a curse. Satan is constantly at work with the intense energy and under 1,000 disguises to misrepresent the character and government of Yahweh. With the extensive, well-organized plans and marvelous power, he is working to hold the inhabitants of the world under his deception. Yahweh, the one infinite and all-wise, sees the end from the beginning, and in dealing with evil, his plans were far-reaching and comprehensive. It was his purpose not merely to put down the rebellion, but to demonstrate unto all the universe the nature of rebellion. Yahweh's plan was unfolding, showing both his justice and his mercy, and fully vindicating his wisdom and righteousness in his dealings with evil. For the holy inhabitants of other worlds were watching with the deepest interest the events taking place on the earth. In the condition of the world that existed before the flood, they saw illustrated the results of the administration which Lucifer had endeavored to establish. In heaven, in rejecting the authority of the Assyrian, casting aside the law of Yahweh, and those high-handed sinners of the antediluvian world, they saw the subjects over whom Satan held sway, for the thoughts of men's hearts were only evil continually. Every emotion, every impulse and imagination was at war with the divine principle of the purity and peace and love. It was an example of the awful depravity resulting from Satan's policy to remove from Elohim's creatures the restraint of his holy law. By the facts unfolded in the progress of the great controversy, Yahweh will demonstrate the principles of his rules of the government which have been falsified by Satan and by all whom he has deceived. His justice will finally be acknowledged by the whole world. Though the acknowledgement will be made too late to save the rebellious, Elohim carries with him the sympathy and approval of the whole universe. As step by step his great plan advances to his complete fulfillment, he will carry it with him in the final eradication of the rebellion. It will be seen that all who have forsaken the divine precepts have placed themselves on the side of the Satan in the warfare against the Yahshua. When the prince of this world shall be judged, and all who have united with him shall share his fate, the whole universe as witnesses to the sinners will declare, "Just and true are thy ways, our King of Saints." End of chapter 5. And Adam was given another son to be the inheritor of the divine promise, the heir of the spiritual birthright. The name Seth, given unto his son, signified appointed or compensation. For, said the mother, Yahweh hath appointed me another seed instead of Abel, whom Cain slew. Seth was of more noble stature than Cain or Abel, and resembled Adam more closely than did his other sons. He was a worthy character, following in the steps of Abel, yet he inherited no more natural goodness than did Cain. Concerning the creation of Adam, it is said, "In the likeness of Yahweh made he him." But man, after the fall, begat a son in his own likeness, after his image. While Adam was created sinless, in the likeness of Yahweh, Seth, like Cain, inherited the fallen nature of his parents. But he received also the knowledge of the Redeemer and instruction in righteousness. By the divine grace, he served and honored Yahweh, and he labored as Abel would have done, and he lived to turn the minds of sinful men to reverence and obey their Creator. And it saith to him also there was born a son, and he called his name Enos. Then began men to call upon the name of Yahweh. The faithful had worshipped Yahweh before, but as men increased, the distinction between the two classes became more marked. There was an open profession of loyalty unto Yahweh on the part of one, as there was of contempt and disobedience on the part of the other. Before the fall, our first parents had kept the Sabbath, which is instituted in Eden, and after expulsion from paradise, they continued its observance. They had tasted the bitter fruits of disobedience and had learned that for every one that tramples upon Yahweh's commandments will sooner or later learn that the divine precepts are sacred and immutable, and that the penalty of the transgression will surely be inflicted. For the Sabbath is honored by all the children of Adam, that remained loyal unto Yahweh. But Cain and his descendants did not respect the day upon which Elohim had rested. They chose their own time for labor and for rest, regardless of Yahweh's express command. Upon receiving the curse of Yahweh, Cain had withdrawn from his father's household. He had first chosen his occupation as a tiller of the soil, and he now founded a city, calling it after the name of his eldest son. He had gone out from the presence of the Yahweh, cast away the promise of the restored Eden, to seek his possessions and enjoyment in the earth under the curse of sin, thus standing at the head of that great class of men who worshiped the God of this world, and that which pertains to mere earthly and material progress. His descendants became distinguished, but they were regardless of Yahweh and in opposition to his purposes for man, to the crime of murder in which Cain had led the way Lamech, the fifth in the descent, added polygamy and boastfully defiant. He acknowledged Elohim only to draw from the avenging of Cain an assurance of his own safety. Abel had led a pastoral life, dwelling in tents or booths, and the descendants of Seth followed the same course, finding themselves strangers and pilgrims on the earth, seeking a better country that is in heavenly. For some time, the two classes remained separate, the race of Cain spreading from the place of their first settlement, dispersed over the plains and valleys where the children of Seth had dwelt, and the latter, in order to escape from their contaminating influence, withdrew to the mountains and there made their home. So long as this separation continued, they maintained their worship of Yahweh in his purity, but in the lapse of time they ventured little by little to mingle with the inhabitants of the valleys. The association was productive of the worst result. The sons of Yahweh saw the daughters of men that they were fair. The children of Seth, attracted by the beauty of the daughters of Cain's descendants, displeased the Yahweh by intermarrying with them. Many of the worshippers of Yahweh were beguiled into sin by the allurements that were now constantly before them, and they lost their peculiar holy character. Mingling with the depraved, they became like them in the spirit and in deeds. For the restrictions of the seventh commandment was disregarded, and they took them wives of all which they chose. The children of Seth went in the way of Cain. They fixed their minds upon worldly prosperity and enjoyment, and neglected the commandments of Yahweh. Men did not like to retain Yahweh in their knowledge. They became vain in their imagination, and their foolish heart was darkened. Therefore Yahweh gave them over to a mind void of judgment. Sin spread abroad in the earth like a deadly leprosy. For nearly 1,000 years Adam lived among men, a witness to the results of sin. Faithfully he sought to stem the tide of evil. He had been commanded to instruct his posterity in the way of the Yahweh, and he carefully treasured what Yahweh had revealed unto him and repeated unto the succeeding generation. To his children and children's children, to the ninth generation, he described man's holy and happy state, a state in paradise. Then repeated the history of his fall, telling them of the suffering of which Elohim had taught him the necessity of strict adherence to his law, and explaining to them the merciful provision for their salvation. Yet there were but few who gave heed to his words, Often he was met with bitter reproaches for the sin that had brought such woe upon his posterity. Adam's life was one of sorrow and humility and a contrition. When he left Eden, he thought that he must die, thrill him with horror. He was first made acquainted with the reality of death in the human family when Cain and his firstborn son became the murderer of his brother. Filled with the keenest remorse for his own sin and doubly bereaved in the death of Abel and the rejection of Cain, Adam was bowed down with the anguish. He witnessed the widespread corruption that was finally to cause the destruction of the world by a flood. And though the sentence of death pronounced upon him by his Maker had at first appeared terrible, yet after beholding for nearly 1,000 years the results of sin, he felt that it was merciful to Yahweh to bring an end to life of suffering and sorrow. Notwithstanding the wickedness of the antediluvian world, that age was not, as has often been supposed, an era of ignorance and barbarism. The people were granted the opportunity of reaching a high standard of moral and intellectual attainment. They possessed great physical and mental strength, and their advantages for acquiring both religious and scientific knowledge were unrivaled. It is a mistake to suppose that because they lived to a great age, their minds matured late. Their mental powers were early developed. And those who cherish the fear of the Yahweh and live in harmony with His will continue to increase in knowledge and wisdom throughout their life. Could illustrious scholars of our time be placed in contrast with men of the same age who lived before the flood, they would appear as great inferior in mental as in physical strength. As the years of man have decreased and his physical strength has diminished, so his mental capacities have lessened. There are men who now apply themselves to study during a period of from 20 to 50 years, and the world is filled with admiration of their attainments. But how limited are these acquirements in comparison with those of men whose mental and physical powers are developed for the centuries. It is true that the people of modern times have the benefit of the attainments of their predecessors. For the men of the masterly minds who planned and studied and wrote have left their work for those who know. Or for those who follow. But even in this respect, and so far as merely human knowledge is concerned, how much greater the advantages of the men of that olden time. They had among them for hundreds of years him who was formed in the Yahweh's image, whom the Creator Himself pronounced good, the man whom Elohim had instructed in all the wisdom pertaining to the material world. Adam had learned from the Creator the history of creation. He himself witnessed the evidence of events. 9 centuries,
events.
Or the events of 9 centuries, and he imparted this knowledge to his descendants. The antediluvians were without books. They had no written records. But with their great physical and mental vigor, They had strong memories, able to grasp and to retain that which was committed unto them, communicated unto them, and in turn to transmit it unimpaired to their posterity. And for hundreds of years, there were seven generations living upon the earth contemporaneously, having the opportunity of consulting together and profiting each by the knowledge and experience of all. The advantages enjoyed by men of that age to gain a knowledge of Yahweh through His works have never been equal since. And so far from being an era of religious darkness, there was an age of great light. All the world had opportunity to receive instruction from Adam, and those who feared the Yahweh had also Yahshua and angels for their teachers, and they had a solid witness to the truth in the garden of Yahweh, but that for so many centuries remained among men at the cherubim guarded gate of paradise. The glory of Yahweh was revealed, and hither came the first worshippers. Here their altars were reared and their offerings presented. It was here that Cain and Abel had brought their sacrifices, and Yahweh had condescended to communicate with them. Skepticism could not deny the existence of Eden while it stood just in sight, its entrance barred by watching angels. For the order of the creation, the object of the garden, the history of its two trees, so closely connected with man's destiny, were undisputed facts. And the existence and supreme authority of Yahweh, the obligation of His law, were truths of which men were slow to question, while Adam was among them. Notwithstanding the prevailing iniquity, there was a line of holy men who elevated and ennobled the communion with Yahweh, lived as in the companionship of heaven. They were men of massive intellect, of wonderful attainments. They had a great and holy mission to develop a character of righteousness, to teach a lesson of righteousness not only to the men of their time, but for future generations. Only a few of the most prominent are mentioned in the scriptures. But all through the ages, Yahweh had faithful witnesses, true-hearted worshipers. Of Enoch it is written that he lived 65 years and begat a son. After that, he walked with Yahweh 300 years. During these earlier years, Enoch had loved and feared Yahweh and had kept His commandments. He was one of the holy line, the preservers of the true faith, the progenitors of the promised seed. From the lips of Adam, he had learned the dark story of the fall of the cheering and the cheering of one of the Elohim's graces as seen in the promise. And he relied upon the Redeemer to come. But after the birth of his first son, Enoch reached a higher experience. He was drawn into a closer relationship with the Yahweh. He realized more fully his own obligation and responsibility as a son of Yahweh, and as he saw the child's love for his father, his simple trust in his protection, as he felt the deep yearning tenderness of his own heart for that firstborn son, he learned a precious lesson of the wonderful love of Yahweh unto men and the gift of his Son, and the confidence which the children of Yahweh may impose in their Heavenly Father for the infinite, unfathomable love of Yahweh through Yahshua became the subject of his meditations day and night. And with all the fervor of his soul, he sought to reveal that love unto the people among whom he dwelt. His walk with Yahweh was not in a trance or a vision, but in all the duties of his daily life. He did not become a hermit, shutting himself entirely from the world, for he had a work to do for Yahweh in the world, in the family, and in his intercourse with men, as a husband and a father, a friend, a citizen. He was a steadfast, unwavering servant of Yahweh. His heart was in harmony with Yahweh's will. For can two walk together except they be agreed? And this holy walk was continued for 300 years. There are few Christians who would not be far more earnest and devoted if they knew that they had but a short time to live, or that the coming of Yahshua was about to take place. But Enoch's faith waxed stronger, his love became more ardent with the lapse of centuries. Enoch was a man of a strong and highly cultivated mind and extensive knowledge. He was honored with the special revelations from Yahweh. Yet being in a constant communion with the heaven, with a sense of the divine greatness and perfection, ever before him, he was one of the humblest of men. The closer connection with Yahweh, the deeper was a sense of his own weakness and imperfection. Distressed by the increasing wickedness of the unrighteous and fearing that their infidelity might lessen his reverence for Yahweh, Enoch avoided constant association with them and spent much time in solitude, giving himself to meditation and prayer. Thus he waited before the Yahweh, seeking a clearer knowledge of his will, that he might perform it. To him, prayer was as the breath of the soul. He lived in the very atmosphere of heaven. Through holy angels, Enoch revealed to Yahweh revealed unto Enoch his purpose to destroy the world by a flood. And he also opened more fully to him the plan of redemption. By the spirit of prophecy, he carried him down through the generation that should live after the flood, and showed him the great events connected with the second coming of Yahshua and the end of the world. Enoch had been troubled in regard to the dead. It had seemed to him that the righteous and the wicked would go to the dust together, and that this would be their end. He could not see the life of the just beyond the grave. In prophetic vision, he was instructed concerning the death of Yahshua, and was shown his coming in glory, attended by all the holy angels to ransom his people from the grave. He also saw the corrupt state of the world, when Yahshua should appear the second time, that there would be a boastful, presumptuous, self-will generation denying the only Elohim and Yahshua Messiah, trampling upon the law, and despising the atonement. He saw the righteous crowned with glory and honor, and the wicked banished from the presence of Yahweh and destroyed by the fire. Enoch became a preacher of righteousness, making known unto the people what Elohim had revealed unto him. Those who feared the Yahweh sought out this holy man to share his instructions and his prayers, he labored publicly, also bearing Elohim's message unto all who would hear the words of the warning. His labors were not restricted to the Sethites, in the land where Cain had sought to flee from the divine presence. The prophet of Yahweh made known the wonderful scene that had passed before his vision. Behold, he declared, Yahweh comes with 10,000s of his saints to execute judgment upon all and convince all that are unholy among them of their unrighteous deeds. He was a fearless reprover of sin. While he preached the love of Yahweh and Yahshua unto the people of his time and pleaded with them to forsake their evil ways, he rebuked the prevailing iniquity and warned the men of his generation that judgment would surely be visited upon the transgressor. It was the spirit of Yahshua that spoke through the Enoch. That spirit is manifested not alone in the utterances of love, compassion, and entreaty. It is not smooth of things only that are spoken by holy men. Yahweh puts into the heart and lips of his messengers truths to utter that are keen and cutting as a two-edged sword. The power of Yahweh that wrought with his servant was felt by those who heard. Some gave heed unto the warning and renounced their sin, but the multitudes mocked at the solemn message and went on more boldly in their evil ways. The servants of Yahweh are to bear a similar message to the world in the last days, and it will also be received with unbelief and mockery. For the antediluvian world rejected the warning words of him who walked with the Yahweh, so will the last generation take light of the warnings of the Yahweh's messengers. In the midst of a life of active labor, Enoch steadfastly maintained his communion with the Father. The greater and more pressing his labors, the more constant and earnest were his prayers. He continued to exclude himself at certain periods from all society. After remaining for a time among the people, laboring to benefit them by the instruction and example, he would withdraw to spend a season in solitude, hungering and thirsting for that divine knowledge which Elohim alone can impart. Communing thus with Yahweh, Enoch came more and more to reflect the divine image. His face was radiant with the holy light, even the light that shineth in the face of the Yahshua. As he came forth from these divine communings, even the unrighteous beheld with awe the impress of the heaven upon his countenance. The wickedness of men had reached such a height that destruction was pronounced against them. As year after year passed on, deeper and deeper grew the tide of the human guilt. Darker and darker gathered the clouds of the divine judgment. Yet Enoch, the witness of faith, held on his way, warning, pleading, entreating, striving to turn back the tide of guilt and to stay the bolts of vengeance. Though his warnings were disregarded by a sinful, pleasure-loving people, he had the testimony that Yahweh approved, and he continued to battle faithfully against the prevailing evil until Yahweh removed him from the world, from a world of sin, unto the pure joys of heaven. The men of that generation had mocked the folly of him who sought not to gather gold or silver or to build up possessions here, but in his heart was upon eternal treasures. He had looked upon the celestial city. He had seen the King in his glory. In the midst of Zion, his mind, his heart, his conversation were in heaven. The greater the existing iniquity, the more earnest was his longing for the home of Yahweh. While still on earth, he dwelt by faith in the realms of light. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see Yahweh. For 300 years, Enoch had been seeking purity of the soul, that he might be in harmony with the heaven. For 3 centuries, he had walked with Yahweh. Day by day, he had longed for a closer union. Nearer and nearer had grown the communion, until Yahweh took him to himself. He had stood at the threshold of the eternal world, only a step between him and the land of the blessed. And now the portals open, the walk with Yahweh so long pursued on earth continued, and he passed through the gates of the holy city, the first from among men to enter there. His loss was felt on earth. The voice that had been heard day after day and the warning and instruction was missed. There were some, both of the righteous and the wicked, who had witnessed his departure. And hoping that he might have been conveyed to some one of his places of retirement, those who loved him made diligent search, as afterwards the sons of the prophets searched for the Elijah, but without avail. They reported that he was not, for Yahweh had taken him. By the translation of Enoch, the Yahweh designed to teach an important lesson. There was danger that men would yield unto discouragement because of the fearful results of the Adam sin. Many were ready to exclaim, "What profit is it that we have feared the Yahweh and have kept his ordinances, since a heavy curse is resting upon the race and death is a portion of us all?" But the instruction which Yahweh gave unto Adam, and which was repeated by Seth and exemplified by Enoch, swept away the gloom and darkness and gave hope unto man, that as though Adam came death, so through the promised Redeemer would, and that as through Adam came death, so through the promised Redeemer would come life and immortality. Satan was urging upon men the belief that there was no reward for the righteous or punishment for the wicked, and that it was impossible for men to obey the divine statutes. But in the case of Enoch, Yahweh declares that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. He shows that what he will do for those who keep his commandments. Men were taught that it is possible to obey the law of Yahweh, that even while living in the midst of the sinful and corrupt, they were able, by the grace of Yahweh, to resist temptation, become pure and holy. They saw in his example the blessedness of such a life, and his translation was an evidence of the truth of his prophecy concerning the hereafter. With this award of joy and glory and immortal life unto the obedient, and of the condemnation, woe, and death to the transgressor, by faith Enoch was translated that he should not see death, for before his translation he had this testimony that he pleased Yahweh. In the midst of a world by its iniquity doomed to destruction, Enoch lived a life of such close communion with Yahweh that he was not permitted to fall under the power of the death. The righteous character of this prophet represents the state of the holiness which must be attained by those who shall be redeem from the earth. At the time of Yahshua's second advent, then as in the world before the flood, iniquity will prevail. Following the promptings of their corrupt hearts and the teachings of a deceptive philosophy, men will rebel against the authority of heaven. But like Enoch, Yahweh's people will seek for purity of heart and conformity to his will until they shall reflect the likeness of Yahshua. Like Enoch, they will warn the world of Yahweh's second coming and of the judgment to be visited upon a transgression, and by their own conversation and example, they will condemn the sins of the unrighteous. As Enoch was translated to heaven before the destruction of the world by water, so the living righteous will be translated from the earth before its destruction by fire, says the apostle. We shall not all sleep, but we shall be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trump. For the Elohim himself shall descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of the archangel, and with the trump of Yahweh. The trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed. The dead in Yahshua shall rise first, then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Yahweh in the air, and so shall we ever be with the Yahweh. Wherefore, comfort one another with these words. In the days, so that's the end of chapter 6. We're now going into chapter 7. It's entitled The Flood. In the days of Noah, a double curse was resting upon the earth in consequence of Adam's transgression and of the murder committed by Cain. Yet this had not greatly changed the face of the nature. There were evident tokens of decay, but the earth was still rich and beautiful in the gifts of Elohim's providence. The hills were crowned with the majestic trees, supporting the fruit-laden branches of the vine. The vast garden-like plain were clothed with a verdure and sweet with the fragrance of a thousand flowers. The fruits of the earth were in great variety and among almost without limit. The trees far surpassed in size, beauty, and perfect proportion any now to be found. Their wood was of a fine grain and a hard substance closely resembling stone and hardly less enduring. Gold, silver, and precious stones existed in the abundance. The human race yet retained much of its early vigor, but a few generations had passed since Adam had access to the tree which was to prolong a life. And man's existence was still measured by the centuries. Had that long-lived people, with their rare powers to plan and execute, devoted themselves unto the service of Yahweh, they would have made their Creator's name a praise in the earth and would have answered the purpose for which He gave them life. But they failed to do this. There were many giants, men of a great stature and strength, renowned for wisdom, skillful in devising the most cunning and wonderful works, but their guilt in giving loose rein to iniquity was in proportion to their skill and mental ability. Yahweh bestowed upon these antediluvians many and rich gifts, but they used His bounties to glorify themselves and turn them into a curse by fixing their affection upon the gifts instead of the giver. They employed the gold and silver, the precious stones, and the choice wood in the construction of habitations for themselves and endeavored to excel one another in beautifying their dwelling with the most skillful workmanship. They sought only to gratify the desire of their own proud hearts and reveled in the scenes of the pleasure and wickedness. Not desiring to retain Yahweh in their knowledge, they soon came to deny His existence. They adored nature in the place of the Yahweh of nature. They glorified human genius, worshipped the works of their own hands, and taught their children to bow down to graven images. In the green fields and under the shadow of the goodly trees, they set up the altars of their idols, extensive groves that retain their foliage throughout the year, were dedicated to the worship of the false gods. With those groves were connected beautiful gardens, their long winding avenues overhung with the fruit-bearing trees of all descriptions, adorned with the statuary and furnished with all that could delight the senses or minister to the voluminous desires of the people, and thus allure them to participate in the idolatrous worship. Men put Yahweh out of their knowledge and worshiped the creatures of their own imagination, and as a result they became more and more debased. For the psalmist describes the effect produced upon the worshiper of by the adoration of the idols. He says, they that make them are like unto them, so is every one that trusts in them. It is a law of the human mind that by beholding we become changed. Man will rise no higher than his conceptions of the truth, purity, and holiness. If the mind is never exalted above the level of humanity, if it is not uplifted by faith to contemplate infinite wisdom and love, the man will be constantly sinking lower and lower. The worshippers of the false gods clothe their deities with the human attributes and passions, and thus their standard of character was degraded to the likeness of sinful humanity. They were defiled, and the consequence, Elohim saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that they were every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. The earth also was corrupt before Yahweh, and the earth was filled with the violence. Yahweh had given men his commandments as a rule of life, but his law was transgressed in every conceivable way. Sin was a result. The wickedness of men were open and daring. Justice was trampled in the dust, and the cries of the oppressed reached unto heaven. Polygamy had been early introduced. Contrary to the divine arrangements at the beginning, the Yahweh gave unto Adam one wife, showing his order in that respect. But after the fall, men chose to follow their own sinful desires, and as a result, crime and wretchedness rapidly increased. Neither the marriage relation nor the rights of property were respected. Whosoever coveted the wives of or the possessions of his neighbor took them by force, and men exulted in their deeds of violence. They delighted in the destroying the life of animals and the use of flesh for food, rendered them still more cruel and bloodthirsty until they came to regard human life with astonishing indifference. The world was in its infancy, yet iniquity had become so deep and widespread that Elohim could no longer bear with it. And he said, I will destroy a man whom I have created from the face of the earth. He declared that the spirit should not always strive with the guilty race. If they did not cease to pollute with their sins the world and its rich treasures, he would blot them from his creation and would destroy the things with which he had delighted to bless them. He would sweep away the beast of the field and the vegetation which furnished such an abundant supply of food, and would transform the fair earth into one vast scene of desolation and ruin. Amid the prevailing corruption, Methuselah, Noah, and many others labored to keep alive the knowledge of the true Elohim and to stay the tide of moral evil. 120 years before the flood, the Yahweh by a holy angel declared unto Noah his purpose and directed him to build an ark. While building the ark, he was to preach that Yahweh would bring a flood of water upon the earth to destroy the wicked. Those who would believe the message and would prepare for that event by repentance and reformation should find pardon and be saved. Enoch had repeated to his children that Yahweh had shown him in regard to the flood, and Methuselah and his son, who lived to hear the preaching of Noah, assisted in building the ark. Yahweh gave Noah the exact dimensions of the ark and explicit direction in regard unto its construction, in every particular. Human wisdom could not have devised a structure of so great strength and durability. Yahweh was the designer, and Noah the master builder. It was constructed like the hull of a ship, that it might float upon the water. But in some respects, it more nearly resembled a house. It was 3 stories high, with but one door, which was on the side. This brings in verse 30. Contact us at the 11th hour. Call us number 11. Click on our audio archive. We're going to close now with a song. What a friend we have in Yahshua.
What a friend we have in Yahshua. All our sins and griefs to bear. What a privilege to carry everything to Yah in prayer. Oh, what peace we often forfeit. Yah, what needless pain we bear. Oh, because we do not carry everything to Yah in prayer. Every trials and temptation, is a trouble anywhere. We should never be discouraged. Take it to the Yah in prayer. Can we find a friend so faithful, who will all our sorrows share? Yahshua knows our every weakness. Take it to the Yah in prayer. Are we weak and heavy laden, cumbered with the load of care? Precious Savior, still our refuge, take it to the Yah in prayer. To the friends despised, forsake thee, take it to the Yah in prayer. In his arms yet taken shield,